Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
That was like you'd see in the movies, the old-style cell house. Concrete tiers, steel bars, I think it was six levels high, and then two buildings wide. It was just enormous. Noisy, dank, scary. When you were new, it was almost like nobody would waste a breath on you until you could show whether or not you could sink or swim on your own. Basically, it was, here's your cuffs, here's your keys, there's your tier up there, we'll see you in 8 hours.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and this is Chris Hubert. Chris used to be a corrections officer at the former prison on McNeil Island. You probably picture the guards and the prisoners separated by solid steel bars. And they often were, but Chris says that other times, he and the inmates were stuck on the same side of a locked door.
There's some pictures of the gates to the old auditorium where it was a giant, it was an actual sort of almost like a Broadway-style theater. It had wings in the back, and it was like you could do a professional. In fact, the first time I ever went to McNeil was in 76 or 7 when I was a student at Tacoma Community College, and I was in a play there called A View from the Bridge, and we went and performed at the prison. So then when you worked there, you would get put into the auditorium, and that's the only place where the guys had to watch TV. So it was dark in there because they had to be able to see the TVs, and you would just kind of be locked in there. I didn't have a key to get out because they didn't want people to overpower me and get out before it was time. And you were basically there just to kind of babysit some very, very bad babies.
Chris says most of the time things stayed pretty well under control, but you never knew when one of those so-called bad babies was going to misbehave.
You hear about them talk about it in law enforcement or combat, where it's hours and hours or days and days of tedium, punctuated at times by moments of terror. You know, I mean, we had a guy when I was first out there. He was the state prison weightlifting champion. And he must have got hold of some bad Pruno or something, because he was ripped one night and just going crazy. And so, you know, we're trying to subdue him. Somebody could have got hurt really bad. We didn't. But in the heat of the moment, my training takes over. I don't even really have to think about it. I just do what needs to be done. And then after everything's all over and the offender's secured, that's when I get the shakes and I kind of go, oh crap, that just happened, you know? So you can never forget that even though most of the time everything's fine, it's the kind of place that can go from 0 to 90 in a heartbeat.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is gatekeepers, what it's like to hold the power over who gets to come and go, and why that power is not always what it's cracked up to be. You could argue the ultimate gatekeeper, the overseer of one of the most impenetrable places on Earth, is the government of North Korea. It's often called a hermit state, where defecting is punishable by death. But even there, people slip through. People like Grace Jo, who was 6 years old when her mom scooped up her and her older sister and set out to cross the Tumen River into China.
We walked like 3 nights and 4 days. It was very tough days because it was unpaved road. And sometimes there are a lot of tree branches are very hurting our skins. A lot of wild animals sounds we can hear at night, and we have to hide from people. And when we get to the river, it was very dangerous too, because water level reached my mom's hip. However, my mom managed, all three of us were able to cross the river and come to China.
But escaping North Korea and finding freedom are two different things. 5 years later, Jo and her family were captured and deported back to North Korea. The fact that she's alive, not imprisoned or executed, is kind of miraculous. In fact, she and hundreds of others of North Korean refugees owe their lives to the Seattle area man we're about to meet. Pastor John Yoon is short and balding. At 81, he's ruggedly handsome, if a little stern, but his face still lights up with a smile sometimes. His voice is quiet and intense, and it tells a story full of international intrigue and brushes with death. We got help from his daughter, Grace Yoon Yi, who's a professional interpreter. They begin when John Yoon was 12. It was 1951 in Korea, north of the 38th parallel, and war was breaking out.
Bombs everywhere, exploding everywhere, and it was just war everywhere. And there were a crowd of people just moving and moving.
Those crowds were moving south. Yoon's parents were supposed to follow, but the fighting made that impossible. He would never see his mother and father again. In South Korea after the war, Yoon set about making a life. He worked, joined the military, and then he had a transformative experience at a place called Mount Yongmun. There's a church there. Yoon went, he says, to see if God was real.
As I was praying one night from heaven, this big of fire just fell upon my back. The spirit of fire was upon me. It was burning me. At that moment, I really knew that God was alive.
Yoon decided to throw himself into ministry. He did missionary work in Russia and China when he heard about the famine and desperation inside North Korea. Yoon organized food aid, but he was discouraged by how much was skimmed off by corrupt officials. Then he became aware of another group of people just as desperate as the ones still in North Korea.
When I was in China, I noticed that there were so many North Korean refugees who needed help and who was just dying there. And I have seen so many of these people who desperately needed help, and I just thought that I had to help them.
That's when Pastor John Yoon became a conductor on the North Korean Underground Railroad. He would help ferry groups of refugees from the border region deep into China and then onto a neutral country. It was a high-stakes world of informants and shady traffickers and allies who turn out to be enemies. And for the refugees, there was the constant danger of arrest and deportation.
It's a long journey. We have to get on the train. We have to get on the boat. We have to get on bus, motorcycle.
Yoon remembers a group of 32 North Korean refugees who made that trip to Thailand in clusters of twos and threes. Every stop was a chance to get caught.
So I was so worried about these 32 people. I had to go this way and this way to avoid meeting the police officers and all that. And finally, when we arrived in Bangkok, meeting the consul, the South Korean consul, I felt like I was seeing my grandfather.
Yoon has helped orchestrate dozens of these escapes. But that group of 32 sticks in his mind, partly because it was an especially big caper to pull off, and partly because of what came after. Those refugees were due to be followed almost immediately by another group of 19 North Koreans. At the time, they were laying low, waiting for the green light.
So all these 19 people were hiding in my apartment in China, and they were about to leave the next morning when police just came to my apartment, just arrested everyone, and repatriated these North Korean refugees back to North Korea.
Someone had snitched to the authorities. Yoon was anguished by the betrayal, but there was no time for heartache. The police were after him, too. Luckily, someone tipped him off, and he fled to the U.S.
Because my identity was already disclosed, and they were trying to arrest me, so I couldn't go back to China with my original name, with my original passport. So I legally changed my name, changed the passport, and I re-entered China after that.
Would you ask him to say his new name?
그럼 이름을 뭐로 바꿨었던 거죠?
필립 준 박.
Philip Jun Buck.
As Philip Buck, Pastor Yoon returned to China and quickly got back to ferrying refugees towards safety. Then in 2005, he was organizing the transport of a group of North Koreans into Mongolia. He'd hired a guide to lead them on a specific route.
The guy didn't listen to me. The guy just went round and round and round to different routes, eventually coming back to the starting point where there were Chinese police and officers were. So they all got arrested at that time. There was another North Korean defector that I have hired for help. She also was arrested at that time. Her mother was arrested. Her younger sister also was arrested. And when they got arrested, they told the police about who I was, where I was. So that is why I also got arrested at that time.
Yoon had always known this could happen. The specter had hung over his work for decades. And now it had. John Yoon was locked up in a Chinese prison for the next 15 months.
While I was in prison, I felt like I was living in hell. And I don't want to talk more details about it.
Can you talk about how it felt when you were released?
그렇다면 석방되었을 때 기분이 어땠는지 좀 말씀해 주시겠어요?
날아갈 것 같았다니까.
I felt so happy, so lighted. I felt like I could fly.
U.S. diplomats helped secure Yoon's release, and he returned to the U.S. Still, Yoon's career as an Underground Railroad conductor was effectively over. But the story was not. Also imprisoned at the same time as Yoon was a family he'd been trying to help, including a then 11-year-old girl.
My name's Grace Jo, and I was born in North Korea.
This is that little girl whose mother carried her across the river into China when she was six. She and her family spent the next 5 years there, mostly in hiding. She didn't realize her situation was unusual until her family was caught and deported.
Before I sent back to North Korea, actually, I was thinking I was same as other Chinese little girls. But when I sent back to North Korea, I found out I was different and I can never become same as other girls. After I sent back North Korea, I went to the prison first and then sent back to the orphanage shelter. I saw many children were struggling, starving, beaten by other older kids. Like all those injured kids were hiding at the corner and covered with blankets. And all those things when I see, I feel like so sad. I feel like, wow, how can this country can be my country?
Jo's prospects were not good. Her family had illegally crossed the border. They were Christian, and they had accepted help from foreigners. These are all categories of major crime in North Korea. Jo assumed that they would be executed.
But I think God's miracle happened there because of Pastor Yoon bribed six officials from North Korea. So the North Korean government were able to release us. And we were able to cross the river again, and yeah, now we are here.
Fresh off his own captivity, Yoon had tracked down the family and paid $10,000 for their release. Thanks to that bribe, Jo and her family now live in Washington, D.C. When we talked, she was visiting New Vision Church in Linwood on the occasion of Pastor John Yoon's retirement.
Since then, I called him Grandpa. When he retires, how can I not come?
The church sanctuary was filled with congregants and a contingent of 28 North Korean defectors, including Grace Jo, her mother, and others whose lives were saved by John Yoon. Fellow missionaries and clergy offered heartfelt testimonials to Yoon's career, the 300-plus refugees he rescued, and the countless souls they believe he saved through spreading the gospel. There was a massive meal and even music from an all-North Korean refugee choir. Pastor Yoon was visibly moved. A progression of people loaded him down with bouquets and plaques until the little man was all but hidden underneath them. But even here, he couldn't bring himself to celebrate.
I want to help them more. I want to do more for them. And because I can't, physically unable to do so, I feel terribly sorry. Even to the present day, I'm always thinking about the ways to save those who are dying. I'm always thinking about the ways to save them.
John Yoon's mission may be over, but there are now hundreds of people in South Korea and the United States who owe their lives to him, and he hopes that some of them will keep the Underground Railroad running for another generation. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about gatekeepers. For a government, the authority to take someone's life is one of the most solemn and controversial powers there are. Capital punishment was outlawed in Washington State in 2018. Before that, the law required that anyone sentenced to death be given a series of appeals and opportunities to challenge their fate. The assumption is that the condemned person wants to live. But what if he or she doesn't? Who gets to decide when to give up those challenges and just accept a death sentence? The state, who's supposed to ensure justice, or the convicted person? In other words, who gets to be the gatekeeper of that most final of penalties? In 1989, Wesley Allen Dodd put that question to the test. His crimes were shocking, and please be aware, this story deals with disturbing subjects. It's really not meant for kids, so please keep that in mind. It lasts about 20 minutes. The story comes to us from the podcast Here Be Monsters. Sound Effect contributor Bethany Denton takes it from here.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Why don't we start? Can I have you introduce yourself?
My name is Becky Price. I was the one that got the booklet from Wesley Allen Dodd.
AP Wire, January 1st, 1993. Killer writes girl on how to foil molesters. Child killer Wesley Allen Dodd, scheduled to be hanged Tuesday in Washington State, sent a 6-year-old girl a booklet he wrote on how to avoid child molesters, the child's grandmother says. The 9-page booklet arrived in November for the granddaughter of Sandra Clemens. Clemens has exchanged letters regularly with Dodd. Clemens said she's been writing to condemned killers for about 20 years, and said, as a Seventh-day Adventist, she believes killing is wrong even if it's condoned by the government. Clemens, 48, helped her granddaughter Becky read the booklet. She said, quote, "Becky was happy to get the book. She was excited. She was proud of it." The booklet's hand-printed text begins, quote, "My name is Wes, but since you don't really know me, I am a stranger to you. I am the kind of stranger that you should stay away from."
It was a purple construction paper tied with pink ribbon and a pretty bow. It had about, I'd say like 10 pages in it, I believe. And then everything was handwritten and hand-drawn in the book.
The booklet was called When You Meet a Stranger.
I remember he said, if somebody tries to grab you, kick them, scream, yell at the top of your lungs, run away as fast as you can. He wanted to protect children from people like him. And who better to get that advice from than a child killer? Mm-hmm. I don't really know what all he did, and I really don't want to know.
In 1989, Wesley Allen Dodd raped and murdered 3 young boys in Vancouver, Washington, a city just north of Portland. The boys were brothers Cole and William Neer, ages 11 and 10, and 4-year-old Lee Isley. The police caught Wesley a few weeks later at a movie theater where he had tried to abduct another child. He quickly confessed to the 3 murders and pled guilty. Prosecutors wanted the death penalty, even though no one had been executed in Washington since 1963. Death penalty cases are complicated, and they take a lot of time. often years, sometimes decades. Part of this is because there are a number of appeals built into the process. These appeals are designed to make sure that the courts haven't made any mistakes with the death sentence, checking for things like juror misconduct or incompetent defense lawyers. Sometimes juries take a long time to make a decision, and often anti-death penalty advocacy groups will get involved and try to stop the execution. So the death penalty takes time, a long time. In 1990, Americans spent on average about 8 years on death row before their execution. And that's not what Wesley Allen Dodd wanted. Wesley's case files describe him as competent, intellectually intact, rational, and able to make sound judgments about his welfare. And that's important to know, because Wesley's case was unusual at the time.
He was writing to my grandmother a lot, and they loved each other, but most of the time it was arguments, because he wanted to die and she wanted him to live. She would say, it doesn't matter if you want to live or die. God put you here for a reason. And there's people that love you, that care about you, that's going to hurt when you're gone. And he would tell her, I deserve to die.
Wesley Allen Dodd was a volunteer. That's the term for it. He was a volunteer for his own execution, and possibly the first one ever in Washington State. He didn't want to appeal the sentence. He didn't want his attorneys to present evidence that might warrant leniency. And this asked a big legal question. Did he have the right to do that? Did he have the right to agree with prosecutors? He wrote letters to the court, antagonized his lawyers, and went on TV to argue the same thing again and again. Murderers deserve to die. He was a murderer. He deserved to die. He wanted to die, and it was his right to do so.
Why do you want to be executed?
I have to be. Because I will kill again. I've been molesting kids nonstop since I was 13 years old, over half my life. Anything happened, I can guarantee I'd do it again, and sooner or later I would kill another child. You know, right now I'd sit here and say I don't want to, but I know it'll happen.
Thank you. I wonder if next we might ask Mr. Darrell Lee, who was attorney for Wesley Allen Dodd, to give us some personal, professional opinion on the issues of the death penalty in general, lethal injection, hanging, as it related to Mr. Dodd, your experience with it. A broad forum.
Now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's go.
All right. Why did Wesley Allen Dodd fire you?
I guess you'd have to ask Wesley Allen Dodd. I don't know. I mean, I could speculate.
Gil Levy is a criminal defense attorney in Seattle. He and another lawyer represented Wesley Allen Dodd for a short time.
My recollection is that he was remorseful and ashamed of what he did. Felt that he deserved to get the death penalty. Or the other possibility is that he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison, which he undoubtedly would. People like Wesley Allen Dodd, based upon the nature of their crimes, crimes against children, sexual crimes, things like that, makes them vulnerable to assaults by other prisoners. So they have to check themselves into what's referred to as protective custody, but in fact is basically solitary confinement. So if Wesley Allen Dodd didn't get the death penalty, he'd probably have to spend the rest of his life in protective custody.
Do you remember anything about the time you met him?
We talked about the Seahawks.
You're a Seahawks fan?
Was. Shortly after we were appointed, we met with the client once, after we met with him, he wrote a letter to the Washington Supreme Court asking to waive his appeal and be executed as quickly as possible.
In his letter to the Supreme Court of Washington, Wesley wrote, quote, "It is my desire that the appellate procedure be as short as possible and that there be no appeal filed that isn't absolutely required by law," end quote. And then a little further down in the letter he wrote, quote, "I feel my trial was very fair and that the jury made the only decision possible." He underlined the word only for emphasis. He included a note from a social worker to affirm his mental state was sound and that his decision was not coerced. Gil Levy says he was fired because he and his co-counsel didn't support Wesley's decision to waive all of his appeals. And Gil told me that the courts didn't know what to do with this. It wasn't anything they'd seen before. And even though Gil had been fired, the court asked him to file an amicus brief, basically a petition to the court, where he argued it didn't matter that Wesley agreed with his death sentence. The law is bigger than just him, and the law requires thorough appeals processes.
We argued at the time that he didn't have the right to waive his appeal.
Why wouldn't he have his right to waive an appeal?
I'm sure we argued that the death penalty is unique and different and people change their minds and we should give him all due process before we execute him. I mean, it's a long time ago and I don't remember what the argument was.
The argument between Wesley and his former attorneys made its way to the Washington Supreme Court. It was 1992, 3 years after Wesley had been arrested. The court appointed Wesley a new lawyer, a man named Darrell Lee. Darrell supported Wesley's desire to be executed. In a 7-2 decision, the court ruled that Wesley did, in fact, have the right to waive his remaining appeals. Wesley considered it a victory. And Darrell Lee got interviewed for the newspaper, saying, quote, "He's always been firm in this. He's never wavered, and he's assured me that it is not his intention to change his mind." 3 months later, on January 5th, 1993, the state of Washington hanged Wesley Allen Dodd. There was a crowd of about 150 people gathered outside the penitentiary. They cheered when he was pronounced dead a few minutes after midnight. A local newspaper described the mood as jubilant, despite the cold. Anti-death penalty demonstrators were also in the crowd, though they were outnumbered 3-1.
And I suppose I do have a unique perspective since I'm the only person who witnessed the execution, who also spent a couple hours with Mr. Dodd before he died and got close, somewhat knowing of him over the months preceding his execution.
This is Wesley's lawyer, Darrell Lee, speaking to the Washington legislature a few weeks later about the state's methods of execution.
I will give my compliments to Mr. Spalding and his staff. The execution was clean, swift, tasteful as executions can be. It was certainly efficient. It was painless. I can assure you that Mr. Dodd, if that's your concern, felt absolutely no pain. Some people suggest or perceive that hanging is barbaric. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's good for people out in our community to have that additional thought that, you know, if I kill somebody, they're going to put a rope around my neck. Because I suspect, like most of you here, I have very mixed feelings on the death penalty. I would like its use to be as available, but extremely restricted. And if hanging is barbaric, well, let's let the jury think about that. Let's not let them think, well, we're just putting him to sleep. We're doing him a favor.
Did your execution do any good?
I think it would. I think a few child molesters, anyway, are going to think twice before they do anything again.
How do you live with yourself daily?
At times it's not easy. Like I said, there's times I think about what I've done. think about some of the things the boys said before they died, and that's real hard to think about. At other times, I just try to put everything out of my mind.
Do you look forward to dying?
In a way, yeah. I think it'd be a relief. I don't have to think about all these things anymore. And I know that's the only way I can guarantee I'm not going to hurt anybody else.
It is not at all unusual, in my experience, for a person facing the death penalty, at least at some point along the way, to say, I just want to give up. But in every case where I've had somebody say that, they've changed their mind later.
Jeff Ellis is a defense attorney in Portland. He represents people on death row and does anti-death penalty work. He remembers Wesley's case well because he was a young lawyer at the time and was just starting to gravitate toward capital cases.
And I guess that what bothers me the most about cases where a lawyer is completely supportive of the individual's desire to be killed by the state. I mean, it's like seeing a jumper on a bridge, except the person isn't a jumper. There's a police officer ready to push the person over the bridge. And the lawyer says, is this really what you want? Yeah, it is. Okay, go ahead and do it. You know, anytime anybody hears someone say, I want to die, I want my life to be ended, that ought to provoke a much more in-depth inquiry and sustained conversation. And the brutalizing effect of the death penalty is oftentimes it skews that and sort of says, well, what? If he said he wants it, you know, who are we to stand in the way of it?
Yeah, I'm so that all makes a lot of sense to me, and I agree. And then even just yesterday, though, working on this story and sort of thinking about, like, okay, so we have this person who committed these unbelievable acts of violence and cruelty, who a lot of the public really supported his death sentence. Obviously, the courts and even some of his attorneys supported his death sentence. So for him to say, look, I've thought about it, and what makes the most sense for me is that we just go get this over with as soon as possible, mm-hmm. so that the families can move on, so I can't do this to anyone else again. He even said, you know, maybe this will send a message to other people who are like me, who have these urges, that they might think twice. Wouldn't that be a win-win? You know, if Dodd doesn't want to live in shame and in fear, if the people he's hurt don't want him to live, that also seems kind of compelling to me.
Yeah, well, but why not just do that then for anybody, no matter what crime they've committed or frankly they haven't committed, but who says, you know, look, I'm thinking about doing these things, so kill me before I do them.
But he didn't just think about it. He did it. He did those things.
No, I get that. But I guess your argument that we should give over this sort of choice to a defendant, you know, where does it stop? And I've seen that intense remorse. I've seen that intense shame. I've met people, you know, sometimes hours after they've killed, who have that. And who want to die to remove that feeling, you know, both as reflective of I deserve to be punished for what I did, but also take this away from me, take this away, this dread, this remorse, this anguish that I feel. And I do not at all want to make light of that, but that's a human response. And it's something that I think people need to work through. You know, I'll say this: I'm interested in who Wes Dodd might have turned out to be, and I'm interested in, you know, if he had lived, wouldn't it have been more valuable for him to give detectives, police officers, insight into his thoughts, his patterns, instead of taking those things to the grave? And I, you know, I'm not all that interested in taking away an individual's guilt. If I do something that's wrong, I want to feel guilty about it. I don't want somebody to take that away from me. And I tell my clients, and you know, this is the one thing that I continually tell clients, and it sort of is, you know, when somebody did a murder, it's wrong. They deserve punishment for that. I'm not, and I want them to feel guilty because that's the right human response. So you tell me that Wes Dodd felt guilt, and I'm telling you that tells us something about his humanity that everybody overlooked in this desire to say, well, let's get rid of him.
Wesley Allen Dodd was one of Washington's last executions. Governor Jay Inslee declared a moratorium on the death penalty in 2014, and 4 years later, the Washington Supreme Court ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. However, the state has a bit of a history of abolishing the death penalty and then bringing it back again later. There were 21 years between Wesley's execution and the moratorium, and in that period, the state successfully executed 4 more inmates. And of those 4, 2 of them followed Wesley's lead and waived their rights to appeal. Gil Levy, Wesley's one-time defense attorney, is glad that there isn't a death penalty in Washington anymore. He doesn't like to think about Wesley's case or his role in it. Remember, he is the one who argued that Wesley didn't have the right to expedite his own execution. I asked him if his views had changed since he made that argument in 1992.
I thought about how I was going to answer this question, bearing in mind that I'm against the death penalty, so I don't think anybody should get the death penalty under any circumstances. But if somebody says, look, I don't want to spend the rest of my life in solitary confinement. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. Prisons are terrible places, and they are. I mean, prisons aren't nice. So I think that decision is one that should be respected.
I think the core question wrapped up in all of this is, what purpose do prisons serve? Are they there to remove dangerous people from society? Are they there to rehabilitate criminals? Or are they there to exact punishment and retribution? And if you're stuck in a system expecting to wait decades before anything changes, what do you tell your lawyer? I believe that Wesley Allen Dodd was penitent. I think that's why he wrote a self-defense booklet for kids. I believe that he thought that his death would help more than it would harm. But I also think most suicidal people tell themselves the same thing. That the world is better off without them. The thing about death is, there are always people left behind. What about them?
She cried for days when he died. She was heartbroken. She stayed in bed and she cried. She would get up and she would go to the bathroom and she'd go right back to bed. It was like she had lost a child. Because they fought like mother and son. And my grandma's one thing all the time was when people would say, well, he killed somebody, so he has to die, or she killed somebody, so she has to die. And it says an eye for an eye in the Bible. And she'd go, it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. She goes, but you know what that does? That just makes the world blind and toothless.
Sound Effect contributor Bethany Denton produced that story. A version of it originally aired on the podcast Here Be Monsters, distributed by KCRW. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today the theme of our show is gatekeepers. This next story is about who gets to leave a war-torn country and start fresh in the United States.
After the Vietnam War, people in South Vietnam who had supported the United States presence and war effort, you know, they were treated like the enemy.
This is Allison Krupnik. She lives in Seattle. In the late 1980s, she was a young, ambitious foreign service worker for the U.S. State Department.
I was certainly idealistic, the way you are when you're in your 20s. I was arrogant, the way some people are, I certainly was, in their 20s. And the world, at least for me, the world was a really positive place and change was going to happen. And I really, really wanted to be part of that change.
Then Krupnik was thrown into a complicated and pretty grave situation. She was sent to Ho Chi Minh City to help deal with a humanitarian crisis. More than a decade after the Vietnam War officially ended, huge numbers of Vietnamese were fleeing the country by boat. People were dying at sea, and refugee camps were overwhelmed. As part of what was called the Orderly Departure Program, or ODP, Allison had to interview people to decide who would be allowed to resettle in the U.S. As she explains it, one group of Vietnamese were guaranteed entry, so-called AmerAsians, the children of U.S. servicemen and Vietnamese women.
AmerAsians, or children of these servicemen, they looked different, they were treated badly. There were plenty of men who were in Vietnam during that time who married these women and raised families with them, brought them to the U.S. and raised families. But there were a lot of Vietnamese women who were left pregnant or with young children, never to hear again from, the fathers of their children. If you were a family that had an AmerAsian child, you immediately signaled that you had been cavorting with the enemy. So they were hidden. You know, I think in some cases they were cast out of homes. It's horrible, horrible to be an AmerAsian. They were called, I think it was Children of the Dust. So part of the responsibility the United States took was to say, okay, we are going to allow these children of our servicemen or contractors to resettle in the United States, and they are allowed to bring with them their birth mothers, their blood siblings, or, and this is where it got really murky, foster families. So suddenly you have a whole enterprise of people selling their kids to quote unquote foster families who would then have a ticket to resettle. So the hardest part of our job was determining, first of all, if someone who claimed to be an AmerAsian really was, and often they had no documentation, no birth certificates, no family registers. And then second, our job, and this was very, very challenging, was to determine whether the people that came to the interview with the AmerAsian were actually family members. And to try and uncover the truth, that is really the truth, versus what someone believes they have to do or make the truth in order to be successful. So AmerAsians, at the time that we were doing these interviews, they were young. You know, they were teens, early 20s, and not necessarily educated or with the maturity to make assessments about, you know, what to do when you're standing in front of a scary official who doesn't speak your language fluently and tell your story. And the interview rooms were really intimidating. There were these stark rooms with metal chairs, and every time somebody got up or sat down in a chair, moved the chair, it made that horrible screechy sound that metal chairs can make. And even though I and my colleagues with the State Department had had Vietnamese language training and were certified to be fluent in Vietnamese, it's a tough language though, you don't get fluent in a year, we were required to have a Vietnamese government interpreter in the room with us. And so you can imagine if you're coming in for an interview and there's a Vietnamese government official there, you know that anything you say is being noted by that Vietnamese government official and you want to be really careful. So they'd come into the room and the first order of business was determining, is this an AmerAsian or not? Sometimes it's really obvious. If an African American soldier had a child with a Vietnamese woman, you could usually tell that the child was, you know, not pure race Vietnamese, and it would be easy to make that determination. But sometimes it wasn't easy. People are people. People look different, no matter what race or country they come from, and it can be challenging. So somebody would come into the room, and if it wasn't obvious that they were AmerAsian, I would have to dig deep in myself and decide, can I make that call alone or do I want other opinions? And sometimes I wanted other opinions. And so it was pretty common when we weren't sure to get up, take the AmerAsian or the person claiming to be an AmerAsian with us and go into some of the other interview rooms and ask other people for their opinions. I think about it now, it just seems horrible and so humiliating, and I'm ashamed to talk about this, but it was a way of getting some kind of validation. So say that I come into your room, you're another interviewer, you're in the middle of interviewing somebody else, and I come walking in with a young person and I say, what do you think? And you stop what you're doing and you look at me and you either say yes or you say no or you say, you know, this person's ears look a little bigger or their hair is a lighter shade or something. You say all this. And sometimes if my gut told me I wanted to approve someone, but I didn't feel like there was quite enough there, I knew who to go to, which interview team members to go to if I wanted them to say yes. And I knew who to go to if I wanted them to say no. I mean, we definitely all had personas, right? And there were some people that were harsher than other people. Two of the guys that I worked with had Vietnamese wives and Amerasian children of their own and had a long experience in Vietnam and were very compassionate people. And then a couple of the Immigration and Naturalization Service guys had been Border Patrol people. So their mindset was really, really different. It was a keep people out, only let the right people in. So totally subjective. So that was the first really difficult part of the work. The second really difficult part of the work was all the people that came with the Amerasian. So trying to figure out, are these really your family members? Or are these people that had the means to buy their way into bringing you into their family and adding you to their register? You know, I mean, it's like anything, right? You look for nuance. And so the kinds of things we would look for were, how did everybody dress? Like, was there a definite distinction between the poverty level of the Amerasian and how everybody else was dressed? If the Amerasian showed up in rags and the foster family was all dressed up, well, that right away says something about how cared for this person is. Did they sit together? Did they interact in the way that a family might interact? You know, warmth and affection, you're trying to pick up those things. Was everyone allowed to speak their story? And so often we'd separate them. So we talk to the Amerasian alone and say, tell me the story of how you came to live with this family. How do they care for you? Those kinds of things. And then interview the family separately and ask them and check and see if the stories match. There was only one time in 4 years of doing this work where an Amerasian actually said to me, this is not my real family. Every other time, even if I didn't believe it was a true family, everybody always insisted, no, 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 we're a real family. I look at my personal balance sheet of the time that I spent working in Vietnam and I try to really, you know, sort of assess, what do I think? During the time that ODP existed, over 630,000 people were resettled via ODP. So that's 630,000 people who did not have to escape by boat. And I feel good about that. One of the things that I find so upsetting in what's happening in our country now and our country's attitude around immigration, our current president's attitude around these things is horrible because I've seen what's possible and I believe in what's possible. I understand there's a concern about bringing criminals into the country. There's also the public burden aspect of it. You know, the idea that if you open the floodgates and let people come in who are going to need social services, we can't necessarily support that. But I do think that even if you can't always say yes to them, you can treat them with dignity. You know, you can care for mothers and children in a humane way. There is no excuse not to do that. If we lose our humanity, we lose everything.
Allison Krupnik lives in Seattle. She writes about her experience in Vietnam in her memoir, Ruminations from the Minivan, Musings from a World Grown Large, Then Small. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Bethany Denton, Paula Whistle, Kari Plog, and Adrian Flores. Special thanks to Jeff Emptman and the podcast Here Be Monsters from KCRW. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila, music by Blue Dot Sessions. Get in touch at soundeffect@knkx.org. You can hear Sound Effect as a free podcast. Find us in all the places, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, wherever. And you can always tell your smart speaker to play the podcast Sound Effect. We're back next week when our theme is You Can't Change Your Family. Can you? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.